This is Bob Lang with the Oral History Project of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today is September 23rd, 2009. This is the first session in the oral history interview with Professor Anatole Beck of the Department of Mathematics. So, to begin the interview, if you would state for the record your birth date and birthplace, and then begin with a description of who your parents were.
Okay. I was born on March 19th, 1930, in New York City. And my parents both came to the United States shortly after the First World War, separately. The Jews of Europe were in large part wanting to leave, and many of them did leave. My parents came from the western edges of the Russian Empire.
Oh.
My mother came from the city of Brest-Litovsk on the River Bug, which became Polish as a result of the Versailles Treaty. But it is now a principal city of Belarus. My father came from the city of Kovno in Lithuania, which Lithuanians now call Kaunas. It was, between the wars, the capital of Lithuania, because the capital, Vilna, also known today as Vilnius, had been taken over by the Poles as a result of some conflict over territory. They both came to New York City, and they were both in the garment trade.
Did they leave Europe because of anti-Semitism, or because they just wanted a better life?
Both. That's one of the aspects of the better life.
Absolutely.
And my mother came in officially, although at the time it wasn't yet, it was before the law of 1922 restricting immigration. My father came in, and I don't know the story about this. I know he was captured by the Germans during the First World War and put into a labor battalion. And somehow he got hold of papers belonging to another man in another name. He entered the United States, after which he took the name of his uncle, who had a business in Utica, New York. My father's name was originally Bakovich. It's not clear to me where that name comes from. His uncle, when he came to the United States, took the name Beck. And so that was my father, and my mother came from as I said, from Brest-Litovsk. Her father was a sage of the Talmud, which meant he spent the day, every day, in the shul, in the synagogue, and he was by virtue of being such an eminent person, he made a very good marriage by the conditions of those days. When I tell you what it meant, his wife received as her dowry a dairy.
A dairy?
A dairy, which she could operate to maintain the family. Because someone had to maintain the family. On the other hand, within the context of breast effect of Eastern European Jewry, this was a good marriage for her. Because my grandfather had the credentials of a judge, although he didn't behave as a judge. He behaved as a scholar. My mother came over with the younger of her two brothers, older than her, and with her younger sister. Already in the United States, her eldest sibling was a woman married to a man in South Carolina. In southern South Carolina, actually the last village on the road to Georgia, to Savannah, on US 1.
Really?
Of course, US 1 didn't exist at the time, but it's this tiny little village of, now why can't I think of the name? I've forgotten the name. I have trouble with names these days. Mm-hmm. Her elder brother settled in the South Carolina Piedmont.
Oh.
A tough go for Jews.
Mm-hmm. I would think so.
And as it turned out to be, for my cousins especially. At any rate, that's what brought them to the United States. Mm-hmm. My mother became a citizen. My father didn't until much later, and I'll tell you about that later. I'm going to start I ought to first tell you about me in Wisconsin, mm-hmm. and then I'll tell you a little bit about the background of that,
okay.
which is pretty hairy in its own way. Okay, when I first came to Wisconsin after my graduation from college. Mm-hmm. I had what I thought was a generous fellowship from Yale to start that fall. Mm-hmm. Actually, it would pay my $500 tuition and $500 to live on.
And what year are we talking about?
1951.
Okay.
And I came here because this was one of the two schools in the United States that had a genuine graduate program in the summer, the other being Berkeley. Hmm. Other schools had, you know, remedial courses for people who had flunked courses or wanted to advance or something. But here I came and I registered for two courses and audited a third. From people who would eventually become my colleagues. Mm-hmm. And one of the courses I took was taught by a young man briefly graduated from, he wasn't graduated, it's a peculiar thing, he had been a junior fellow at Harvard. But unlike the tradition of junior fellows at that time, he decided that he would get a PhD. And so he did get a PhD from Harvard, and then he came here as an assistant professor, and he was teaching a course out of a new book, fairly new book, Theory of Games and Economic Behavior, mm-hmm. by von Neumann and Morgenstern. Von Neumann being a man who was, by many accounts, the best mathematician of the 20th century. Hmm. And Morgenstern being a very significant economist from Princeton. Mm-hmm. I think von Neumann's PhD was from Princeton, but I'm not sure.
Oh, was it?
At any rate, he became a very important man, and the whole thing of game theory appealed to me enormously. I thought it was, first of all, a wonderful subject. And it also filled into my interest in social problems, mm-hmm. which was something which would continue with me to the present day.
And may I interrupt to ask you why you had this interest in social problems?
Well, first of all, my parents were union people. Oh. And I grew up in the period of union strife. Mm-hmm. When I was 6 years old, my father often was arrested on the picket line in New York City. Mm-hmm. So, and even my uncles who went to the Piedmont of South Carolina, the younger brother also mm-hmm. went, but not to the same town, but another one 40 miles away. Mm-hmm. And they were socialists. They received the socialist paper from New York City by mail. Fortunately, that was in Yiddish. Nobody in their little village was able to read it.
Good protection from the Ku Klux Klan.
Right. Socialism, I decided many years later, became so popular among Jews because Jews were desperate for emancipation. And they knew that they would never be emancipated until everyone was emancipated. Mm-hmm. I don't know that they knew this explicitly, but they had no trouble adopting the emancipation ideology, mm-hmm. which was very, very important to them, mm-hmm. and which is less important today now that they are not so hungry for emancipation.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But it's so. At any rate, that's who they were. So that's my background.
Okay.
My background is a union background. Mm-hmm. I'll leave that part. I'll just say that it's there. I came here, and I had been graduated from. Well, I went from here to Yale, and in the first year, I received a postdoctoral fellowship from the NSF.
Oh.
Which enabled me to come a second summer. They would pay the tuition, and they would spread out my fellowship to cover the summer. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was pretty nice. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, and this is important, I had met a young woman through a friend of mine, and I was interested in her. And by the next academic year, I would be wooing her. Mm-hmm. Of course, I was in New Haven, and she was in South Brooklyn.
Oh.
And I spent a lot of time on this effort. The result of which was I did not have that scholarship, that fellowship renewed. but I made my mark in the department there. I wasn't the top of the heap, but the top of the heap was very good. Mm-hmm. The top of the heap when I was there was a man who was there a year ahead of me. He was a veteran of the Second World War. Mm-hmm. And he subsequently stayed at Yale all of his life, all of his working life, and became chairman of the department, which was significant for me when I was very eager to place a student from here in a very good school.
What's his name?
His name is Jonathan Kaplan, and his father is a professor of law.
Oh, okay.
And he was in my first year graduate course when he was a senior at West High.
Really?
Right, and by far the best student in the class. Hmm. So I wrote to my friend at Yale, Dear George, I have a student for you. This is a student you really want. I gave him some specifics, but I was very aware of the fact that I was talking to someone I knew, someone who would take my words seriously.
And the name of that colleague at Yale is?
It's George Seligman. And he was immensely popular among the students. He was a very nice man. I liked him. And so, as I said, I did a good job at Yale, but I think I was thought of, probably accurately, as not sufficiently driven.
Really? Even as you were working for your PhD?
Even as I was working for my PhD, I had gone to Yale with the intention of studying with a man named Nathan Jacobson. Nathan Jacobson had made his mark. He had come to, he was born in Poland, but as a child, he was moved to Alabama. He grew up in Alabama, went to the University of Alabama, and in 1947, he was a professor at Johns Hopkins, a very fine algebraist. And I wanted to study algebra, or at least I thought I did. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, my first year, Jacobson was on leave. And I took a wonderful course in analysis from a young student. I'll tell you about that later. First, I'll tell you about Jacobson so you will get an idea. So I put off my first year course in algebra for my second year because I wanted to take my algebra from him, having already had a semester's worth of algebra from Bruck here at the university here in the summer of 51. Mm-hmm. I figured, all right, so I'll start with him a year later. And as I describe it, Jacobson and I had two different ideas about what was going on in the classroom. His idea was he would lecture and tell us what he knew, mm-hmm. and we would learn it. My idea is we would come into this class and I would show him how smart I was. Well, he was a very modest man, despite being a very accomplished algebraist. We didn't get along too well.
Huh.
Okay, his idea clashed with mine.
Mm-hmm.
I think I did do some really outstanding work in that class. Nonetheless, I didn't satisfy him, and when the time came for me to take my preliminary examinations, mm-hmm. I had become more and more interested in analysis.
Uh-huh.
And I had left out the last quarter of the year's work in algebra. I just sloughed over it so that when the time came to answer those questions, I was really pretty much lost. And Jacobson actually favored flunking me on my prelim.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
But I think that all things together, people were prepared to, the whole committee passed me.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, I still am a very self-indulgent person. I do what I want to do. What I don't feel like doing, I don't do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you would think that by the age of 79, I would have gotten over this juvenile approach. But it has served me well in life.
I was going to ask you if you're happy with that approach.
I'm happy with the fact that I've done what I wanted to do. I haven't been a success by the ordinary standards, but I've been a success by my standard. That is, I'm probably the poorest paid full professor in my department.
Really?
But on the other hand, I do certain things which they don't consider mathematics, like this.
Mm-hmm. And would you state for the record what this is?
This is a book that I wrote called The Knowledge Business, in which I applied my mathematical thinking to a problem of economics. The economics in this case being the economics of the broader thinking, the university and things like the university.
Mm-hmm.
The pursuit of knowledge and the fact which I seem to be the only one who have found it at the time, at least I didn't hear anybody else talking about it, that the knowledge business was not a millstone on the neck of society, as it was thought in Wisconsin, but an immensely profitable business,
mm-hmm.
paying back a huge multiple of what it cost. But as I have here in the book, I have a chapter called The Paradox,
mm-hmm.
in which the paradox was that almost all the money spent on the knowledge business was wasted.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, most of what we teach to children is not learned. And most of what is learned is forgotten. And most of the research we do is inconclusive. And most of what is conclusive merely verifies what we thought before. Of the stuff which is new, it's very hard to get anything published. And what is published often goes unread. Despite that, if you look at a macroeconomic look, and you look at the world of 100 years ago or 50 years ago, compare it with the world of today, the vast bulk of the difference is due to the increase in knowledge. And the investment, which was made outstandingly, first of all, in the GI Bill, which, for instance, was what funded George in graduate school, and later, during the Sputnik era, when we had to beat the Russians to the moon, the United States government open-handedly supported the knowledge business to the greatest of its ability, but not for the purpose of obtaining the knowledge, but for something else. In the case of the GI Bill, it was because they had a labor problem. They suddenly had 11 million men coming home to a world in which industry would contract, because at that point it was almost all war industry. So jobs were disappearing anyhow. And they had to find something to do with these 11 million men. And one way to keep them off the job market for several years, how many wasn't clear, would be to have them go to school. High school, if that was interrupted, college, or even secretarial school, or learning to fly an airplane, or almost any kind of school was eligible. In addition to that, the federal government helped them buy houses and so on. But it was all part of recovering from the disruption of World War II. In the case of the Sputnik era, before the Sputnik era, which represents all of my education, all of my higher education, all of my graduate education, which was before the Sputnik era, things were very tight. It was very hard to get a fellowship. It was very hard to even get an assistantship. Those things almost didn't exist. But in 1957, as one of my colleagues said, they saw a sign in the sky being Sputnik. And they knew that they were going to have to do something to redeem Kennedy's promise to beat the Russians to the moon. And it was, again, the federal government became open-handed, not just in science, though that was their major interest, science and engineering, but also in languages and cultures and everything. I mean, the universities demanded that government support everything, although they supported science more. But it was a very open-handed situation, which ended shortly after Neil Armstrong walked on the moon, because the race had been won. It was time to stop running. So now, why did I tell you that? I've forgotten where I started on this.
Well, we were working on your master's. And then going for your PhD,
right.
You were talking about how you have been essentially self-indulgent.
Very self-indulgent. But I came out of the PhD.
And what was the subject of your PhD?
Well, it was very interesting. I had one subject, which is what I thought I was working on, but in the process of working on that, I essentially reinvented another subject, which had already been invented by one of my professors, but I hadn't heard about it from him. I knew he had written this book called Topological Dynamics, But I thought I was working on probability in Banach spaces. Banach spaces being infinite dimensional spaces with a certain kind of geometric structure in them.
Mm-hmm.
And shortly after coming out of graduate school, I went, well, when I came out of graduate school, I went to a year of postdoctoral at Tulane.
Oh, Tulane?
Yeah.
Why Tulane?
Because that's where there was a grant with a somebody that I went to work with.
I see.
Actually, the Naval Office of Scientific Research was offering 4 assistantships.
Mm-hmm.
I applied for 2 of them, one at Michigan and one at Tulane.
Mm-hmm.
I got the one at Tulane. And I went there, I worked on that. A lot of the work there was preparing my thesis for publication.
Mm-hmm.
But I also developed an interest in topological dynamics, in a particular question which had been unsolved for quite a while, and for which, as it happens, I found a rather simple solution.
Hmm.
But when I went to tell this professor at Yale, named Hedlund, Gustav Hedlund, I said, I can prove that in the plane, every closed set, whatever this means to you, every closed set is the fixed point set of a continuous flow. He said, you can prove that? I said, yes, I can prove that. And it turns out that actually it was really, really quite easy.
Hmm.
In spite of the fact that it was so unusual. I got into that because a colleague of mine thought that the answer to that question was far more restricted. And I could prove a very open situation, what mathematicians call necessary and sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
In order to be this fixed point set, it would have to be closed. And that's all it would have to be. Or if it were closed, there was a flow for which it was the fixed point set.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I went and I told that to Hedlund. Now, in the meantime, I had gone off the next year, in 57, 58, to Europe on a Yale fellowship.
On a Yale fellowship?
Yale fellowship.
Okay.
And I was trying to prove a certain theorem, that in a certain condition, there would be a sort of general probability theorem called the strong law of large numbers, for whatever that means to you.
I will take your word for it.
Right, right. So I wanted to know that in a reflexive case, it would be possible to reduce. There was in that this field just really one theorem. That was that if you loaded up the problem with a lot of assumptions, then the proof which held for one-dimensional spaces or two-dimensional spaces would also hold for infinite-dimensional spaces.
Mm.
And it was a completely routine question, but the people who first put that into print get to call themselves the initiators of the subject.
Ah, okay.
Well, I wanted to reduce the conditions in a certain subset of the Banach spaces.
Mm-hmm.
Banach being the name of the man who wrote a book on that. And when I was caught in a talk in Denmark in Danish, which I don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
I sat and I worked on this problem, and I realized that that wasn't enough, that I could produce a counterexample to the theorem in a reflexive space. That's where I was looking at. I said, I have to give it more hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave it more hypothesis, and this was something called uniform convexity. In a uniform convex space, these random variables didn't have to have the same distribution.
Oh.
They just had to have a restriction on their size, a uniform restriction on their size, in a place which was uniformly convex. And I traveled through Europe, and I got to Paris, and I went to the man who had proven the other theorem. I said, uh-huh. Here's what I can prove. And he said, well, all of this in bad French. he said, you must give us a lecture. I said, I would be delighted to do that. I said, but I have to give it in English. And he said, no, you must give it in French. So I gave it in terrible French.
Oh, you did?
Including pointing a lot at formulas that I'd written on a blackboard, and saying like this in French, comme ça. But the point is, I gave the lecture and I published an abstract of the lecture.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my first major theorem after my PhD.
Mm-hmm.
Now that was in 1958.
And did that get you a fair amount of attention?
Well, actually not immediately, but that was 1958. I was traveling, and I had not yet had a job for 1958.
Mm-hmm.
But I had interviewed for this job in 1956 at Christmas time in Rochester.
Oh.
Where I met and talked to my professors from Wisconsin.
Oh, do you remember who you talked to from Wisconsin?
I remember exactly who I talked to. I talked to Lawrence Young, a very important mathematician, and this fellow Buck, from whom I had learned the theory of games.
Oh, okay.
And I don't think I talked to Professor Brock, from whom I had studied algebra.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, they knew who I was, and they didn't know this result when they made me the offer of an assistant professorship here.
I see. It was in December of that year that you're in Rochester talking to these faculty.
Right, and I told them that I would be away for a year on the Yale Fellowship.
Uh-huh.
And then while I was away, so when I did this work in Denmark, I did not know I was going to Wisconsin.
Hmm.
That came later, because when I did this work was in 57, and then I heard from them in April of 58.
Mm-hmm.
I was delighted to know I was coming to Wisconsin. And this is very important, because at that time, this place was a kind of an Eden. I mean, my guess was that at the time, 30% of all the scientists and engineers in the country would have wanted to come here in preference to anywhere else in the world.
Really?
Yes.
More so than Harvard or Berkeley?
Yes, it's 30%. Today, I think it's 15% or mm-hmm. less, maybe down to 10% now, by now. But Wisconsin had more to offer than Harvard and Berkeley in that it was very special. It was a very special university. It was very innovative and progressive. Things like the experimental college here.
Mm-hmm.
Things like Wharf.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Things like the heritage of the La Follettes. Despite the fact that pulling in the opposite direction was this, at that time, a great favoring of McCarthy,
mm-hmm.
who was very popular among some people in this country and very unpopular among some others.
Mm-hmm.
But you had this was 1958, so it was just a little after 100 years from the time that the German socialists arrived, fleeing the collapse of the revolution in 1848.
Mm-hmm.
They came here and they invented social security and they invented workers' compensation and they invented this and they invented that. It was the city on the hill.
Mm-hmm.
I also knew how beautiful it was. I had come here the two summers. I had learned to sail. And
oh, you have?
Yeah. And I, as I said when I came, you know, it's too bad that in the academic world, you have to go away in the summer, and that's the glorious season here.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew what, when I got the offer, I knew how wonderful this place was at the time. It was not as wonderful as it is now. One of the wonders it had, and this is something that people have forgotten here, is that this place was universally described as having a self-governing faculty.
Mm-hmm.
Self-governing faculty, which over the course of the years became, first of all, faculty governance, and then mixed governance, and then later on, after the coalition, or whatever they call it, I was going to use the German word Anschluss,
to create the UW system.
Yeah, there was already a UW system of six units, but they merged it. Merger was called.
Merger.
And during the time since merger, the regents have repeatedly made the claim that their share of shared governance was 100%. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that on this business of having this furlough business,
mm-hmm.
nobody asked us. That doesn't mean that they were going to do what we said. Nobody asked us.
Mm-hmm.
In 1958, we would have been asked. In 1958, we were the university.
And that was unique in the United States, was it?
Pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
And by 2008, we just were employees of the university.
Mm-hmm.
So there are many ways in which this place was an Eden. And there were people here like Professor Hagen, who was called to Harvard and didn't go.
Oh, Oscar Hagen in art history?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. Uta Hagen's father.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this was like a kibbutz.
Oh, interesting.
And so that made it a very attractive place, especially for an independent person like me.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you got the offer to come here,
yeah.
What did the department hire you to teach? What did they want you to do?
Well, they didn't tell me what I was going to be teaching.
Oh?
Just to be an assistant professor of mathematics.
And they would assign you the courses
right.
to teach?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, the initial courses, once I was here, I could sort of campaign for this or that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, I mean, I was not a special person. I was just a PhD, but I was somebody that they knew. And they didn't know about that result.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't know that a couple of years later, in the summer of 1960, I would go away for the summer to Cornell,
mm-hmm.
where I worked with a man named Jacob Wolfowitz, the father of the fellow in Washington.
Paul Wolfowitz?
Yeah.
Wolfowitz, who was one of the neocons?
Right.
In the Defense Department?
Right. And he and I had lunch almost every day, and we agreed about nothing, almost, and yet we were good friends. But what I did that summer was to take this condition of uniform convexity and invent a different a weaker form of convexity, which I gave my own name to, and proved that not only would that condition give the particular law of large numbers I was interested in, but only spaces with that condition would give it. It was what mathematicians call a necessary and sufficient condition. And I had pulled together two subjects, one from geometry and one from probability, and said, this is equivalent with that. And I thought that was magnificent. That was 1960.
Did you publish that?
I did eventually. And shortly after that, I felt that having, by that time, done four postdoctoral years and was doing the fifth, it was time for me to have an associate professorship. The department didn't agree. I went looking. I was offered an associate professorship at Northwestern, and I offered to stay at Wisconsin if they would match it. And they did match it, and then Northwestern raised the ante, and I refused it.
As you look back, are you glad you made that decision?
Except for one thing. A few years later, my brother became an assistant professor of sociology at Northwestern.
And you would like to have been?
He was very much my younger brother, 8 years younger. When I was 11, my father died, and my brother was three. And so I participated in raising him. So it was a closer relation than some brotherships. So at any rate, I was glad to stay. At the time, I had some friends here. I liked the ambience and so on. And the Wisconsin did go to the point of matching my original offer to the penny.
So they made you an associate and gave you tenure?
Right. Which I would not have had at Northwestern. I would have been a candidate for tenure, but they were not going to hire me at tenure. I was not that distinguished. At any rate, so I stuck to that subject in spite of the fact that it was sort of an outball subject, but I started pushing that, the whole area of probability and Banach spaces was essentially my work up to the time when I got some people interested in it, one of whom was a young Frenchman whose preparation in probability theory. Is this running? Get it. Whose preparation in probability theory was exceptional, and he was, I have to say this, good deal smarter than me. And he sort of took over the subject. And in the meantime, I had taken up working on a different subject. But when I came to give a lecture on my thesis, which was called On the Random Ergodic Theorem, I came to give the lecture. I had asked my professor, a man named Kakutani, whose daughter is now very famous. She's the chief book reviewer for the New York Times. I had asked him whether everyone who got a PhD had to give a colloquium. And he said, no. That's a privilege which we accord to our PhDs. You don't have to do it. You know, it's something we give you.
Not something you have to do.
Right. So in my last year at Williams, in my last year at Yale, when I taught at Williams College for a year, I came down 150 miles to give this lecture at Yale. And the first question I got at the end of the lecture was from Professor Hedlund, whom I have mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, how does your main theorem differ from a similar theorem by Gustav and Hedlund in their book on topological dynamics? I nearly fell through the floor. I had never looked at a page of that book. I knew it existed, but I had essentially invented or reinvented something that they had invented.
Mm-hmm.
But I said to him, Professor Hedlund, what is your theorem? He told me his theorem. And I had to think quickly. And I thought, and I said, Professor Hedlund, the difference between your theorem and mine is that you assume that this set is compact. And in my theorem, the compactness of that set follows from the finiteness of this measure space over here.
Mm-hmm.
So I was using measure theory in a way that to link it into what Hedlund had done. So what I did was not as new as I thought it was.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I realized many years later that I had essentially used in the thesis the methods of topological dynamics without having known what it was.
How interesting.
And this other subject that I was talking about, the continuous flows in the plane, I picked that up from this colleague of mine at Tulane, and I said, now that I know that I have this simple answer to the question of what are the fixed point sets or flows in the plane, I said, that's the wrong question.
Mm-hmm.
That's the wrong question, because the sort of brutal fixed point sets that I used to produce this answer were not the ones we were used to looking at.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones we were used to looking at had a peculiar kind of singularity which occurred in very few circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
It's like when you look at a picture of a ball in an airstream. So the stream of air comes and parts it and goes around it and reconnects at the back.
Mm-hmm.
But in the middle of the front, there is a point where it doesn't part, where the flow actually seems to come in and end there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it doesn't actually end there. It just gets slower and slower and slower forever. Now, not if we're talking about air or water or real things in the real world. If we're talking about points in a mathematical space, there is this point at the front and the point at the back, which I call stagnation points, which are different from other fixed points.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I want to know what happens in a flow where there are a few stagnation points. That's the right question.
Hmm.
And I started working on that question. I wanted to know, A, suppose there are no stagnation points,
mm-hmm.
and B, suppose there are only finitely many stagnation points. And I worked on it on and off while still presenting myself to the world as a probabilist in the field of probability and Banach spaces.
I see.
And I started running international conferences on that and publishing symposia on that,
mm-hmm.
etc. And I was doing that, but I was also carrying this sideline of something which, as far as I knew, nobody cared. I cared.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1967, I took on a pair of graduate students, a husband and wife from Johannesburg University, who had come to Wisconsin to get a PhD.
You're from South Africa?
Yes.
Okay.
And I won a senior postdoctoral fellowship from the NSF for the year 68-69.
Mm-hmm.
and I took them with me.
Oh.
I got research assistantships for both of them. I took them
plus with, your own.
And mine was a research fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
But these were research assistantships. One of them was on my project for the NSF, and the other one was from Worf.
Shall I turn back on?
Yeah. One of the things I discovered a couple of years ago, and I remembered something about myself.
Mm-hmm.
I remembered that when I was about 12 or 13 years old, in junior high school,
mm-hmm.
I knew that what I wanted to be in life was an inventor.
Oh.
Something like Thomas Edison or some other inventor.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had a something which moved me in that direction. But there was no possibility. First of all, I was completely poverty stricken and I had no resources.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, I was clumsy. I couldn't make anything.
Oh.
And thirdly, I was never going to be able to sell anything. Because I didn't have that kind of a temperament.
Mm-hmm.
So I put that fantasy aside.
Mm-hmm.
And then years later, I found that whenever I came up against a problem, not necessarily my problem, something in the newspapers or something,
mm-hmm.
I would approach it and say, what would I do with that if that were my problem? I realized I had become an inventor by becoming a mathematician,
mm-hmm.
which didn't require me to have money, didn't require me to be good with my hands, and I wasn't going to sell anything to anybody, except that there are some people who have a talent for writing introductions to their papers, which sell the papers,
mm-hmm.
and I don't. I mean, for instance, this stands alone. It's not well sold.
Mm-hmm.
All I'm doing is proving my point.
Yes.
I'm proving a theorem, as it were.
As it were.
So that's as far as I go in inventing things. I'm still inventing things.
Oh, good. I want to return now. You were talking about going to Washington. You had the NSF fellowship.
I didn't go to Washington.
Oh, where did you go?
I went to London.
Oh, you went and you took your two...
Actually, I went to England. Let me tell you, I had originally wanted to go back to Israel. I had had a sabbatical in Israel in 1964-65.
I see.
And I wanted to go back because I had already started working in my mind at a book. And that book is my big book, which is almost 500 pages of rather small type, and which includes two chapters which make up Jonathan Lewin's thesis.
Oh.
And two chapters which include Myrtle Lewin's thesis. And I included them because first of all, it was important work. Secondly, I had something to do with creating that work.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted it to be part of the book because I knew that my only chance of reaching people with that work was right there in that book.
Mm-hmm.
That book was published in a series called The basic theory of mathematics, basically,
mm-hmm.
by Springer Verlag,
mm-hmm.
which is not Springer the journalist. This is Springer the scholarly book man.
Mm-hmm. I was sure it wasn't Jerry Springer.
No, I wasn't thinking it was Jerry Springer. I was thinking of there was a Springer who had. Newspapers and magazines in Germany.
Oh.
I forget which one was which. They had different first names and they were not related.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So at any rate, I published this huge book. It was 10 years' work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still my big accomplishment in life is this big book in which I took this generalized problem of continuous flows in the plane. And I didn't finally finish the question I set out to solve, but I moved it far, far along. Mm-hmm. So that this last year, I was in London, and a friend of mine was telling me about a problem he was working on, and why he wasn't understanding this and that. And he showed me what it was that was giving him trouble. And I said, Adam, you've got to read chapter one of my book. You've got to know what a flow is. I mean, none of my big results in the book had anything to do with him, but he had to know that what he was working with was actually a flow. And there were things that were known about flows that he obviously didn't know.
Right. So he had to get that under his belt first.
Right, right. And he's still working on that same material, same kind of material. And surprisingly, that material is in an area called mathematics of finance.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Which is very different from anything I've ever done.
Absolutely. Now, you're in England working on your book, are you?
I have been going back to England for unpaid leave 10 years out of the last 15.
No, I was asking you about when you're at the London School.
The London School of Economics. No, as a matter of fact, that's a different story.
Okay. But this time when you went 64, 65 with your two...
68, 69.
68, 69 with your research associates. Are you working on your book?
Yes, I was. And what happened was, I had applied and had gotten the fellowship to go back to Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
But I could not get appropriate housing in Jerusalem. And I was not going to set foot in Jerusalem unless I had housing in advance.
Mm-hmm.
And having spent the year 64, 65 there, living in an old Arab villa, beautiful place, but very primitive.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't have central heating, for example.
Mm-hmm.
That's important in Jerusalem. It's 2,000 feet up, and it's cold in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, there were three things I had to have. Three things I would have to have. First of all, it had to be centrally heated. Secondly, it had to have three bedrooms, because by that time, my son and daughter needed separate rooms.
Mm-hmm.
The third was, it had to be in a quarter where there were people who spoke European languages,
mm-hmm.
not just Hebrew and Arabic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I could not get those. And I wrote to my friend in England, and I said, I knew that in England I could get housing.
Mm-hmm.
If I was willing to pay for it, I would get it. I wrote to him at Brighton, asking him what was going on in England in topological dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote back to me from Warwick, saying, I am now a professor at Warwick, and we are having a year in topological dynamics, and you are invited to come. And I decided I would come for the fall,
mm-hmm.
and then go to London for the winter.
Oh.
And that was a magnificent year. That was the year in which my wife of the time was finishing her PhD thesis on Kafka and the Yiddish theater, which was published here by the UW Press.
Hmm.
At any rate, so that's what we did. And so each of them had a massive thesis. When you look at how big it was, even when it was published, you know, and I was pleased to have them in that and to do that work with them and to give them all the credit for the work they did. So that the title page of my book says, by Anatole Beck with the assistance of Jonathan and Mirit Lewin, because she had changed her name to Mirit in order to go to Israel.
Oh.
She didn't want to be Myrtle.
Oh.
And she, it turns out the translation of myrtle into Hebrew is Hadassah.
Oh,
and
really?
Hadassah brings up the image of middle-aged Jewish women or older.
Uh-huh.
So she didn't want to be Hadassah. So she just took something that sounded like myrtle, and it was Mirit, which is in itself is a diminutive form of Miriam.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
So, at any rate, that's those people.
Mm-hmm.
And I still maintain contact with those people. They are now divorced, which is, for me, is a tragedy. Not for them. They were people who had problems between themselves, which were well settled by divorce.
Mm-hmm.
But I was sorry to see that happen because they worked so well together. They actually wrote two joint theses, is what they did. He was the more brilliant, and she was the sounder.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so that's a good team.
It's a magnificent team.
Mm-hmm.
So at any rate, so that's when I actually wrote this book. And in the summer of 69, I went to the University Erlangen in Germany. And there my friend at Erlangen introduced me to the mathematics editor of Springer. And that's where I made the contact for the Grundlehren series,
mm-hmm.
which is, by everyone's count, the prime series in mathematics. It comes in a yellow cover, and it's known among mathematicians as the Yellow Peril.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, so that's my biggest accomplishment in mathematics,
mm-hmm.
bigger than my work in probability and Banach spaces.
And by this time, you're a full professor
at
UW?
This time, I'm a full professor at UW.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, when I was visiting in London, I heard that the professorship of mathematics at the LSE, the London School of Economics, was going to be vacated, that it had been advertised already. And to me, that was the best job in the world, because it put together my interest in social problems
uh-huh.
with my interest in mathematics.
Uh-huh.
I would be the professor of the department by the old standard, where there's just one professor in each research group. It's the way it used to be here too. And then we had a new system in which people could be promoted into professorships. When I wanted to be to get the job at London, I had to compete with the world for it.
Oh.
It had been advertised, but not in anything I read. It had been advertised in the bulletin of the London Math Society, and in the New York Times, and in the Chronicle of Higher Education. I'd never seen an ad.
Mm-hmm.
When I got there, a friend of mine told me about it. I went down to talk to the people there and see if they would reopen it for me, and they would.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's quite a compliment.
Yes. I went there with the intention of spending the rest of my life there.
Oh, you did?
Yes.
And so you got leave from Wisconsin to accept that?
Right, I did. And then what happened? Well, it was time for my wife and me to be divorced.
Oh.
The divorce got nasty. And if I were to accede to my wife's demands and continue to live in England, I could not have paid for my children's college education. So therefore, I had to either win the case or be home and having an American salary.
Oh, because your salary in London was much less.
Much less. It was, at the time, it was £8,000 a year. At 280 to the pound.
Mm-hmm.
It was not a lot of money, and prices were high in London, especially for real estate. Mm-hmm. But I would have been making very little money, even without the problem of real estate. Sending children to an American university from England on an English salary without the money I had saved to send them to school mm-hmm. would have been impossible. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't get leave because I had only been there 2 years. So I had to retire. It turned out all for the best. If I had stayed, I would now be in the 14th year of retirement. I'm not retired yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't believe in it.
In retirement?
Well, I believe in retirement, but I don't believe in retirement at 65. Mm-hmm. At least not in non-manual jobs. Mm-hmm. And I've written a book, or I started writing a book on it. I'll send you a copy by email if you like.
Okay.
I got overtaken by the thing that I feared most, which was the renewal of the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. I still don't think we're over this hump.
You're speaking of the economic conditions right now.
Right now. And mm-hmm. I look most directly at the situation of working people. How much work is being done which produces things, not produces money, because mm-hmm. produces money means people taking money from other people. Mm-hmm. So they're not making money, they're just acquiring money.
Correct.
Okay?
Mm-hmm. But I'm with you.
But we've got all those people, all those 6 million people who used to be making things and who aren't making anything, mm-hmm. and who aren't spending anything, mm-hmm. except for their welfare checks. And I don't know how we're going to get over that. I mean, we need another Roosevelt, I think, and we don't have another Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. I mean, I like Mr. Obama, and I say, you know, he's the best person who's been candidate for president in a long time. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, we need somebody better than him. Mm-hmm. We need Roosevelt.
Yeah. Well.
Well, not everybody agrees. I'm just giving you my opinion.
Yeah, well, this is your moment.
Right.
So you left the London School of Economics. You came back.
Came back.
And yeah. I take it you and your wife divorced at that time.
That's right.
And so then you returned to the department here right. as a full professor.
Right. And now I'm remarried.
Uh-huh.
Which is a story in itself. The woman I remarried was one whom I didn't know at the time that I published a book with two other mathematicians, one of whom was a cousin to my present wife.
Interesting. Small world, isn't it?
Right.
So when you returned to Wisconsin, let me ask you, you were involved with the university during the period of the late 60s and early 70s with the turmoil surrounding the war in Vietnam and the Sterling Hall bombing. What are you doing during those years on campus?
Well, during those years, well, first of all, there were the years before I went away and the years after I came back. Mm-hmm. The years before I went away, I can tell you this, as a result of what I will tell you later about my early years up to my college graduation. Mm-hmm. I had acceded to a point of view of my mother's that I should emphasize my education, and she would do plenty of social action on behalf of all of us. Mm-hmm. And whereas I'm not, can't say that I'm proud of it, I agreed to that. Mm-hmm. I came here, I kept my nose fairly clean.
Oh.
When I was at Yale, when I say fairly clean, I was at Yale the what do you call it? The physical plant staff went on strike. Mm-hmm. This was my first year. I wore their button.
Oh, did you?
Which I don't think was popular with the faculty at the math department. Mm-hmm. I didn't do much else. I had my opinions. And that's all it was. Mm-hmm. When I came here, I was also active in a certain amount of activism among the assistant professors, where a lot of people felt we weren't getting a good break. Mm-hmm. I think that we thought that the world had changed and that the people running the university didn't think the world had changed. Mm-hmm. And we knew that they needed us, and for instance, Dean Ingram used to say he can't see any reason to pay a math professor more than he pays a French professor. And my comment was, I agree with him. He should pay a French professor whatever he has to pay a math professor. Mm-hmm. Okay? Uh-huh. But these were just opinions.
Yes.
But I would have lunch with other assistant professors, some of whom were really in distress. We had a very good man here in differential equations who was told by the chairman of math department that they had a lot of math of differential equations people here at the math research center. Mm-hmm. So gave him the feeling that he had no future here, so he went to Minnesota. Mm-hmm. You know, there were a lot of people who went through the assistant professorship here without being promoted to tenure. And I had opinions about that, you know. But in 1962, we had a new assistant professor who came to the department here. And he became involved in the remnants of Local 223 of the American Federation of Teachers. And he got me interested in it. I would go down there, and at the time, dues were very low, and I thought it would be nice to be able to support the American Federation of Teachers by paying my dues, which at the time I could deduct from my income tax, etc. And, you know, I had my opinions. That's what it was. Now, this man became one of my co-authors on that book I told you about. Uh-huh. And in fact, this man is the cousin of my present wife. Uh-huh. But at any rate, I became interested in this, but I still had only my opinions about the university, basically. And then in 1967, my mother died. I realized I had been behaving like a child. By that time, I was a full professor. Mm-hmm. I'd been behaving like a child. Mm-hmm. I'd been letting her carry the can for the family. Mm-hmm. And there were things going on this campus, and I had to be involved in them. Mm-hmm. And I was involved in them. Now, so for instance, in 1970, was the first strike on this campus. Now, I didn't agree with all the tactics of the strike, but I had the feeling that eventually people would recognize that they were being treated like workers and they needed to behave like workers.
This was the TA strike?
Right. Mm-hmm. And I looked at that, and what I saw was, I said, these are people who have been educated by unionized K-12 teachers. Mm-hmm. And so they think it's not so terrible about being in the union. Mm-hmm. And these people have gone from here into universities where they have advocated unionism. Mm-hmm. Because I saw this as something which was growing. Mm-hmm. But what happened with me was I was still a very moderate person. Up until the time when the what do you call that building? The Commerce Building was occupied. And what happened was this. There had been other things, other disorders on campus. And the students said one thing and the police said another. And I said, there should have been some responsible person there to see what was going on. And I recruited a bunch of professors. I said, please go down to the Commerce Building if you have an hour off or something, and just be there and see what's going on. Your testimony may be needed. Well, as it happens, by the time the trouble happened, I was the one who was there. I was on the staircase, on the landing, one half floor up from the entrance to the building. So I had a very good view of what was going on. And when we had the meeting that night in the Union Theater, I went, and the chancellor, whom I considered a good friend, and I still consider that he was always a good friend, he told the story.
Was this Sewell?
Sewell. And then I got up to speak. I say, you have just heard from the chancellor the story of what happened in the Commerce Building as it was told to him. He didn't see it. I was there and I saw it. Let me tell you what I saw. Well, that put the fat in the fire so far as I was concerned. I was telling what I saw. I had no dog in that fight, as they say. I went there specifically so that somebody responsible could be there. And my responsibility vanished immediately as soon as I said that. That is, I was responsible, but my reputation was gone.
So is that the moment at which you become the notorious Anatole Bell?
Yes, that's right. And since then, I have realized that there are times when you have to say things. And I say them. Recently, 9.5 years ago, a professor of journalism was fired from the University of Wisconsin at Superior. The University of Wisconsin at Superior is represented by a local of the AFT. And in that local, the person who is the chairman of tenure and academic freedom is a former student of mine, not a PhD student, but a graduate student, who lives in, and by now he's retired from Whitewater. He was fired in a situation where there was no evidence against him, where was not even a formal charge against him. He was charged originally for having done something, and the charge was withdrawn, so that it was impossible to give the testimony and the evidence that he was innocent of the charge. And he was fired without there being any evidence against him. And the faculty committee met three times, and three times, although they were pressured to find him guilty, they found him innocent. And they're still fighting that case. Now, I'm not fighting that case, because at the time, I was involved in another chapter of another local of the American Federation of Teachers, the one that I joined with my friend, Mike Bleacher, who himself also has his history of social activism. He was at one point professor here, and also Wisconsin Democratic chairman. So, at any rate, I went away to England. When I came back from England, I went to, I was urged by people from the AFT to stand for vice president of the Wisconsin Federation of Teachers. And I did, and I was elected. And I served as vice president, including senior vice president, for 8 years. And then I lost the election in 1983, and I stopped being active in the Wisconsin Federation of Teachers. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't happy about the fact, the way in which I was fired, but of course that's just being vain. But that's an example. So I had that reputation then also as a unionist.
Now, is all of this activity hurting you or affecting your relationships in the mathematics department here?
Not that I know or would attempt to point to. On the other hand, I think what it has cost me is not that I was some kind of leftist or something, but that I was not totally immersed in mathematics.
That you had other significant interests,
right,
not casual interests.
Not casual. And that was part of the reason that I had gone to the LSE. I wanted to do something which von Neumann couldn't do. I didn't realize that. Mm-hmm. And John Nash, does the name speak to you? Beautiful Mind?
Yes, it does.
He couldn't do. Both of these men, I realized after I'd been to the LSE, both of these men had the dream of being the Newton of economics.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Both of these men wanted to do what I wanted to do, but they were much smarter men than me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was smart enough so that when von Neumann came up with something which would work if he only knew a certain thing, I was smart enough to know that he didn't know that thing and was never going to know that thing. He had a theory of what he called utility. And so essentially, to know this theory, you would have to know if you want something, the measure of how much you want it is how much else you're willing to give up to have it.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes,
to know it precisely as a probability. So the kind of question is this: how high a probability of crashing are you willing to risk in order to gain $100 on your airplane ticket?
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yes.
So he would say that everybody not only knows that, but knows it with infinite precision. Well, I don't believe that. I don't believe that he knows it. He knew it. He's died now. I don't believe he knew it. And when Nash said, you have to know not only your own utilities, but the utilities of the person you're dealing with, I said, that's crazy. That's just plain crazy. But the point is, without that, you cannot numericize economics.
Okay.
Without having prizes as real numbers to specify how much something is worth, you cannot do game theory.
Mm-hmm.
Game theory is mathematics. And the thing about mathematics is there were some things, and in the course of the book I discovered a paradox, a fabulous paradox called the paradox of the hare and the tortoise, not Achilles and the tortoise, which is Zeno,
mm-hmm,
but the hare and the tortoise, which is a fable attributed to La Fontaine.
Mm-hmm.
No mathematics in there.
Mm-hmm.
I have a mathematical model that does what nobody will believe. Every time I tell people what this model entails, they say, that can't happen. I say, yes, it can. I've been working on presenting that in a simple way. I've known it was true since 1971, but I've been finally paring it down to the point where I believe I can now finish so that a good undergraduate in mathematics can understand the paradox. Okay, but there are paradoxical things in mathematics. In fact, in my view, it's the paradoxical things in mathematics that give it its flavor and its wonder.
Mm-hmm.
100 years ago, mathematics was about calculations. You had to have calculations made, and only people could make them. Today, almost no calculations by people are trusted without being verified by a machine, except for some calculations which are so complicated that even the machine can't do it, mm-hmm. and you have to find human ingenuity to do them. But that was not what most people were getting in a mathematics education 50 or 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. Most of the mathematicians who worked in industry were just doing what today you would go to a machine to learn. Mm-hmm. And so if we train people that way here, we are training them to be inferior copies of the machine.
Yes, how interesting.
Well, I'm now teaching a course which I claim is the entry course to a mathematical apprenticeship. And I'm stressing the other kind of things, things which speak to people's imaginations. Because that's where the value of mathematics is to be found. And I get into trouble with that with my department, because I'm not giving this course the way it's usually given. Mm-hmm. But I'm giving it the way I'm convinced is the right way to give it. And I get a lot of feedback from students that tell me that I'm right. Mm-hmm. Not all students. There are a lot of students who come in expected to be the way it used to be, mm-hmm. and are very annoyed that it isn't. Mm-hmm. But I say, if the machine can do it, we don't need you to do it. Except to do it on the machine, and you better be able to do it on the machine, because I can't. Mm-hmm. My son is the computer scientist.
Oh. So you have evolved as a scholar into an advocate for contemplation and thinking,
yes.
rather than a technical expert.
Well, not technical. That's a good point. But as a mathematical expert, because there are things in mathematics which are, I mean, one of the, I'll give you an idea. Mm-hmm. I just gave this to my class. Toward the end of the 19th century, there was a man named Cantor who proved that there are different sizes of infinity. That if you look at the infinite number of numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, called the counting numbers, mm-hmm. or if you looked at the infinity of points on a straight line, mm-hmm. there are more points on a straight line than there are in the counting. If you wanted to count out all the points on the line, you couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. No matter how many you counted, most of them would have been left out. Mm-hmm. Okay? Now, that is already a mind blower.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
And when people asked a mathematician named Kronecker what he thought of the work of this man, George Cantor, Kronecker said, "Oh, Cantor is crazy." And as I told my students, Cantor was crazy, but he wasn't wrong. Cantor was crazy. He had mental trouble all his life and died in an asylum.
Oh.
But he has done things in mathematics that none of the stuff of ordinary calculus touches. And like one of those is that there are different orders of infinity. In fact, there are infinitely many orders of infinity. So
really?
Yeah. So that fact, as well as other facts, which I hope to get through to my students, I want them to know how wonderful this stuff is.
Mm-hmm.
And furthermore, I've discovered that what people learn, the most outstanding example is, you were probably taught at some point in high school or something about how to sum an infinite geometric progression.
Yes.
Turns out, my guess is you don't know how to do that today.
You are absolutely correct.
Well, what's much more important is I have had seniors in my classes here who tell me that they have never been taught how to do that. And I say to them, I say, I know for a fact that not only have you been taught how to do this, you've been taught five times before you reach this class, and you've been tested on it, and you've probably all gotten A's on it, and you don't know it. It doesn't touch your soul. It doesn't touch your soul, so you study it for the exam, and then you forget it until the next time you have to study it again for the exam, etc.
Right.
If you teach it, sticks much better, but still, that's technical.
And I would guess that that observation that you've made over the past 3 minutes is not popular in your department.
That's right. That's right. They think that teaching mathematics is teaching that. Now, teaching that is very important, but not the way it's taught, because when I was taught it, I was taught it in high school. I had no idea what it was about. Now, it really never surfaces until you get to junior and senior level mathematics. And you talk about expressing certain functions as series. And you have to know what it means for a series to be convergent. So for instance, there's a series that represents a sine of x. Remember sine of x from?
I do.
The series is x minus x cubed over 6 plus x to the 5th over 120 minus x to the 7th, etc., all in odd terms, and where the denominator for x to the n is n factorial, which means 1 times 2 times 3 up to n. And that series, if you sum it to infinity, is the sine of x.
Yes.
Okay. Now that kind of knowledge, which is 19th century knowledge, is the essence of this subject called analysis. Okay? That's the level at which the mathematician has to become knowledgeable about why this summing a geometric series is important, because it tells you about something called the radius of convergence, where that all makes sense. Because whereas the sine works for all values of x, there are other series that only work for, say, x between minus 1 and 1. And to know what the validity of that subject is, you have to understand geometric series. That's when you have to know geometric. And up until then, you learn it and then you forget it, and you learn it and forget it, and you learn it and forget it. Because it's not close to your soul.
Yes, I love the use of your word of soul in conjunction with mathematics. That never occurred to me.
So the knowledge that there are all these different infinities, that's a wonderful piece of knowledge.
Let me just conclude this. This now concludes the first session with Professor Beck.